cowboy went riding out one dark and windy day. Up on a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, plowing through the ragged sky and up the cloudy draw.
Hello again and welcome to the Real Science Review of the Week. If you're wondering what ghost riders in the sky have to do with real science, we'll come to that shortly. First, I'll point you to a couple of important science-related stories from the past week. Steve Jones caused a wee stussy a few days ago by asking in the pages of the Daily Telegraph if the huge amounts of money invested by the Wellcome Trust to read the message written in human DNA was being wasted. Jones's opinion piece was interpreted for the front page of the Telegraph in a news story that failed to capture the science. To be honest, Jones himself, a seasoned science communicator, buried the real science in the second last paragraph of his piece. To get at that science, you need to look at the New York Times article and the Genetic Future blog posts, which we'll link to in our resources section. There you'll find that the debate is not about whether we should continue to study the human genome at all, but about whether we should be doing it using more and more genome-wide association studies, the scattergun approach mentioned by Jones, which cost millions of dollars each, or trying a different tack, like decoding the whole genome of individual patients. The debate is about how, not whether, to do the science. It's not, as the Telegraph front page would have us believe, about whether the hundreds of millions invested in genetic research would be better spent elsewhere. That is precisely the debate, however, about carbon capture technology, another big science story this week. Coal-fired power stations that don't cause catastrophic climate change seem like a great idea, since coal is plentiful and converting it to electricity is proven technology, unlike many of the methods proposed by the Greens as solutions to climate change. So when the government gave the go-ahead to new coal-fired power stations, as long as they use carbon capture and storage, they probably thought it would be welcomed by environmentalists. And to some extent it has, but not wholeheartedly. Why not? Well, several reasons. They're only making it a requirement to capture 20 to 25% of the carbon dioxide emitted by these new power stations. So the remaining 75 to 80% will still be warming the globe. Secondly, CCS is far from proven technology. Nobody knows if it will work, so we could be building a whole new generation of coal-fired power stations that release huge amounts of CO2 into the atmosphere. And thirdly, mining and transport of coal themselves release carbon dioxide, as does the manufacture of the CCS equipment. And coal-fired power stations fitted with CCS use up to a third more coal than those that don't have it. So for all these reasons, Greenpeace, for instance, has some doubts about the government announcement, but has given it a cautious thumbs up. To me, there's a strange contrast here between that organisation's acceptance that we might find a way to store enormous quantities of carbon dioxide under the earth, essentially forever, and their adamant assertion that we'll never be able to store much smaller quantities of nuclear waste for a few thousand years. There's no doubt that Greenpeace's heart is in the right place, but I sometimes wonder where its head is. So let's get to the ghost riders. I found a book that first fired my love of science in the attic of an aunt's house, where I spent long hours as a boy when we visited in the summer, reading this book and listening to scratchy old vinyl records on a wind-up gramophone. The Marvels and Mysteries of Science was a heavy blue volume with black and white illustrations and glossy pages. The two images that gripped me were a glorious photograph of the spiral galaxy in Andromeda and a diagram comparing the size of our Earth, the Sun, and the star monsters Rigel, Aldebaran, and Betelgeuse. It was my first encounter with the immensity of space. A million Earths could fit inside the Sun. A billion Suns could be squeezed into Betelgeuse. The Andromeda galaxy was so far away that its light, the light of 200 billion stars, took 2 million years to reach us. And way past this nearest celestial neighbour, there were another 200 billion galaxies. My brain couldn't begin to grasp all this. The universe was way beyond anything I knew or could ever imagine. It had just taken my dad what seemed like all day and an old Ford Popular to drive us from Cumnock in Ayrshire to Kirkcaldy in Fife. That was a long drive in those pre-motorway days, but we hadn't even got out of Scotland. and while I was trying and failing to grasp the vast distances in the sky that I could just glimpse through the cobwebbed skylight above my head, the record that played over and over in that dusty old attic was Ghost Riders in the Sky. Song, space and imagination sent shivers up my spine. I loved it. I wanted more of that feeling of wonder at the marvels and mysteries of science. I still do. And the greatest mystery of them all is this. Are we alone in the universe? The discovery of the first exoplanet in 1995 made it much more likely that the answer to that question is no. Until then, our solar system might have been the product of an extremely rare cosmic accident. But we've now found over 300 planets around other suns. 338, in fact, are currently listed by the Planetary Society, our first link in the resources section, including the most recent discovery, the smallest exoplanet yet found, and more are being discovered every month. So we're pretty certain now there are lots of places in the universe that life could exist. So what's so good about small? Why are we interested in small exoplanets? Well, because of the distances, detecting planets of other stars is incredibly difficult, so large planets are easier to find than small ones. But large planets are gas giants like Jupiter and Saturn, where life as we know it has no chance to evolve or survive. We're only just beginning to find terrestrial planets, rocky planets like Earth with a solid surface, and have yet to find a terrestrial planet in the habitable zone, the Goldilocks zone, where it's neither too hot nor too cold, but just right for life. So does it exist? Is there life on other planets? Have a listen to the extract from my interview with exobiologist Giovanna Tinetti, or read the whole interview at scientificblogging.com. And finally, what do you think the name of that first star found to possess a planet was? It was 51 Pegasi. Star 51 in the constellation Pegasus, a constellation named long ago for the winged horse of ancient mythology. Exactly the kind of horse you'd need to chase a herd of red-eyed cows through the ragged sky. That's all for this week from Real Science. Thanks for listening. Keep thinking.
As the riders loped on by him, he heard one call his name. If you want to save your soul from hell, a riding on our range. Cowboy, change your ways. Today are with us, you will ride. Trying to catch the devil's herd across these endless skies. Yippee-yi.